Hello, it's Pat Sharman, co-founder of Everyone Matters and Authentically Consulting. I'm recording the new podcast series, The Culture Debate, exploring what it takes to lead in the world of work today. In this podcast, I'll be talking to two leaders in the field of business psychology to talk about the evolution of hybrid working and the impact to companies and employees. There are no straightforward answers because the success of hybrid working depends on many factors, which I'll be exploring in more detail with business psychologists Andrea and Chris from the global consulting firm Aware. Hybrid working creates tensions between employee needs and organisational goals. In a nutshell, we really need to have a flexible approach to hybrid working so it works for everyone involved, for both companies and for their people. So let's jump in. So Chris, let's start with you. So maybe a good place to start, to begin, would be the psychology of hybrid work and the potential impact it can have on individuals.
Yeah, so we often talk about hybrid work in terms of productivity and logistics. There's a real shift and challenge which is psychological. I'm just looking at some new recent data that suggests that 25 to 35% of knowledge workers in advanced economies will remain remote at least part of the week.
Wow.
So it's not anymore how, if we adapt, but how we adapt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To remote environments and hybrid environments. And when people lose their habits daily that once grounded them, they may also lose their rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mix of outcomes working hybrid. So people value autonomy and flexibility. But the caveat is we also observe increased sedentary behavior, blurred boundaries, and also increased loneliness when working hybrid or working from home.
So do you think hybrid working can impact the kind of sense of belonging as well to a business?
Absolutely. There is a new study that came, a systematic review from 25, that analyzed 42 qualitative and mixed method studies on identity. And that was happening before COVID. So it started in 2018 during COVID and finished last year and outlined seven identities in hybrid workers. Can you imagine? Seven identities from home-oriented to integrated.
So how do you as an organization identify those seven different kind of, I suppose, perspectives on hybrid?
You have to connect with people and you have to be intentional.
Mm-hmm.
So people, when working from their homes or working from a cafe, they have questions around where do I belong? Who am I in the system? Am I a remote worker or a hybrid worker? Or am I actually an employee working in an office?
So what other kind of consequences does hybrid working bring to those individuals? You know, what are the downsides?
I mean, when hybrid working is poorly managed, it can create two classes of employees. And this is data from Harvard Business Review last year. Okay. So it can create a dominant in-office group,
mm-hmm.
and it can also create a remote group that feels generally invisible.
Scary. Okay, so is there anything in between, or you really think that it falls into those two categories?
It depends. It depends on the culture mainly. It depends on the size of the company. My view is that large organizations should have flexible hybrid policies for everyone to be able to opt in and opt out whenever they wish.
We're talking about different kind of categories of people who want to be in the office and those who don't. There must be somewhere in between as well, though. Is there not people that, you know, want to be in for a couple of days, but actually it works really well for them being at home because they have a family to manage?
Yeah, we see anecdotally that early careers in Gen Z
mm-hmm.
want to be more in the office because they learn mostly by osmosis. So they learn by observing others. They learn from informal learning. So they may want to obtain more than 3-4 days weekly, and companies should have that flexibility to allow them to be in. And now carers, parents, mothers, fathers, people who are recovering from injury or illness, they may want more flexibility to work from their home.
Yeah, which completely makes sense. So do you think actually going back to the kind of the early careers, the younger generation, do you think hybrid working has lessened the fun factor of being in the office. I can remember, you know, when I, my last team that I managed, we had a chap called James. If he's listening to this, he'll be giggling this. But we had a daily dad joke, you know, and he made it a real fun factor to be in the office. And I could see that the younger generation are potentially missing out on some of that.
Yeah, possibly. When we work from home or hybrid, there are subtle demands. We have more resources when we work from home. We have mics, we have cameras, we have standing desks, we have pads, we have everything. Mm-hmm. But we have invisible demands such as work loneliness, sedentary behavior and physical activity and exercise, perceived organizational support, which means how our contributions are valued by the organization and how much they care about our well-being. So these invisible demands lead to burnout.
And how is a, so if you're a manager and you're managing, you know, hybrid working, how do you recognize those signs of loneliness or burnout if you're not seeing that person every day?
You have to be intentional. There are many ways to recognize that. You have to be close enough so your employees should feel comfortable, but you need to keep some distance so you can still do your job and be effective. You have to be closer to people that work from home because generally, they're feeling lonely. They're sedentary. They're working 8-10 hours from their desk. And there they're going to the living room to rest. And there they're going in the bedroom to sleep. So they're more than 10-12 hours sedentary. And I want to also point that to distinguish physical activity from exercise and sedentary behavior from exercise, because it's very different and people don't recognize that. So even if you hit the gym 3 times a week or 3 mornings in your daily routine, and you're sitting for long stretches during your workday, you don't avoid any risk of cardiovascular diseases, mm-hmm. heart diseases, all-cause mortality. There's a big meta-analysis that happened 10 years ago in Leicester University, and they reviewed data from nearly 1 million people. This mm-hmm. is one of the biggest meta-analyses. To be accurate, it was 800,000 people on sedentary behavior, and they found that people who are most sedentary had 112% higher risk of diabetes, 147% higher risk of cardiovascular disease, 90% higher risk of dying from heart disease, and a 49% higher risk of all-cause mortality. And here's the key insight. These risks were observed independent of exercise. So you can't out-train a sedentary day.
No, and I must admit, you know, personally, when I was in the office, I found I'm always moving because you're getting up to go to the next meeting, you get up to go, you know, make yourself a coffee, someone comes and chats to you. Whereas when you're at home, I know, you know, when I've worked from home, I always make sure I get up, do a bit of work, go out for a walk, because I actually have to freshen the brain and the number of steps I do.
Now we can monitor them as well with our devices.
Exactly.
Yeah, when I work from home, which is most of the time as well, I find that my step count is really low. So as Chris was saying, then I try to compensate by working out intensively for like an hour. But yeah. it's boom or bust, isn't it? It's finding the middle ground that can really work.
Yeah, it's a really good point to make, Chris. And I know we're going to get on to talk about leadership and how you manage that. But as you know, as a leader or a manager now, you've got to think about all of these things. It's a new dimension to management, definitely.
Yeah. So the impact is physiological, psychological, and social as well.
Yeah.
We also observe in younger professionals and early careers that they don't only wish for a flexible working environment; they wish for a flexible identity.
Yeah.
So one identity that they can shape and grow and not be handed down by hierarchy or leadership.
So a lot to think about there. So thanks, Chris. Just coming on to you, Andrea, in our recent survey that we conducted at Everyone Matters, just under 55 respondents actually thought that hybrid working contributes to company growth. And only 22 respondents thought it hindered company growth. So that's something to really consider. So how can we make sure that hybrid working works for both the people, but also the company?
First of all, as a topic, is hugely complex. You know, it's probably one of the biggest changes to the way we work since the Industrial Revolution. That's what people are saying. And And I suppose, you know, it's understanding what they mean by growth. If it's the numbers, it's one thing. If it's a learning organizational kind of point of view, if it's about even like increasing market share. So I don't know what these variables would mean in reality.
That's true.
But when you think of it, basically you have all these different workers in an organization, and a large organization will have multiple kind of generations in it. Then you have different types of jobs in there. Then you have different personalities that kind of make up, you know, individual differences. So finding this formula of the right amount of flexible working or hybrid working, it just doesn't work. You know, as Chris was saying, there are, for starters, generational differences. You know, early career workers seem to be more affected in a negative way by hybrid work than mid-career workers, which actually tend to benefit from the flexibility and autonomy of hybrid work. Then you got mature workers who, again, you know, have mixed evidence in that way. They have increased flexibility, the ability to care for other people. They don't have to commute, but then they get increasingly lonely and distant from the business. So I think that, you know, this information and this feedback is useful, but it doesn't help in understanding, I suppose, the complexity of the topic itself.
What do you think could... Because obviously we do have this difference of opinion, you know, especially within financial services, that everyone thinks they should be back in the office. So what do you think personally is the right kind of balance? And I know it depends on the role, because there's some roles that just can't be done from home. But if you were managing a business, a large business in financial services, what sort of balance would you have?
I think, you know, I would try and think not in terms of a policy, you know, so to speak, but in terms of the current social architecture of the organization, how we made up. Because, you know, hybrid work has this impact on relationships. You know, we hear a lot of talk around social capital. So social capital is the fabric of human relationships at work. It's made up of trust, for instance, collaboration, informal information sharing, and the ability really to build networks, right? So first I would ask myself, what's the status, the health status of the social capital in the organization? If it's low, then there is a case for reducing or limiting the number of hybrid workers, right? Because, or if you can't do that, there's an opportunity to increase moments, to create moments to get together and build a social fabric that will make up the social capital. So it's like an investment, you know, if we think about financial services, you know, where do you start from? You know, what's your capital investment in that? Do we need to nurture it? Do we need to grow it? If you got strong social capital, then it's a question of building and maintaining it in that way. If you have this strong social capital, performance actually should not be too affected by hybrid working, right? Because you got that foundation that holds the organization together.
Yeah.
The problem starts, and this is why early workers are so affected, they, you know, when there is not enough social capital to build on, to invest, you know, in the organization, then you get situations where, I suppose, you know, people don't really get one to know one another, or where people don't feel a sense of belonging and professional identity in relation to the organization. So I would start with asking some questions, you know, how strong, how sustainable, what's the asset in terms of social capital of this organization? Do we need to build from it? Can we, you know, develop it further? And if it's strong again, how do we keep it going? How do we maintain it?
So again, this comes back to flexibility and the situation. So if, for example, if you had just, you're trying to integrate two companies from a merger, you know that social capital between those two teams might be weaker potentially than what you'd like. So you'd ensure potentially more you know, more times in the office for a period of time to make sure those teams bonded and integrated. So yeah, all of
or create opportunities like away days are a great way, social events, you know, team of size, team building. Now you and I have done a few of those, you know, they're a great way to accelerate trust and get to know one another. But you know, without trust, imagine if you just merged with another company, if you've been acquired, you're working with a bunch of strangers. And again, if you work from home, you're never going to interact with people and build build trust, which is the essential foundational element of any relationship. So in that case specifically, you know, you need to adapt and create these opportunities. The second point I would say would be to review constantly where you're at. You know, the world changes, business change, needs change. And therefore, you can't just, if you like, put together a strategy or a policy and expect it to work for forever for an extended period of times. You may have to revisit it every 6 months, actually.
And that leads us nicely on to leadership, actually. Talking about leadership, do you think we need a new sort of style of leadership, given that hybrid working is, sitting around here, that is here to stay? And do you think we might have lost, there's two questions here, sorry, Andrea, we've lost the art of people leadership just through that, we're going to talk about this compression of learning?
Yeah, well, this became very clear after the pandemic. There were some research, you know, conducted by different bodies, including, I think, Korn Ferry. But, you know, before the pandemic, the number one competency for leaders was customer focus or something to do with the business or drive for results. Post-pandemic, the number one competency that mattered the most was being caring and inclusive. So completely different.
Completely different.
Because now what happens with hybrid working, you can no longer rely on the proximity with other people to, you know, build a culture or to notice what's going on around you. Right? You have to be very attentive. So we need a sort of really relational leadership style, but also very compassionate leadership style and very attentive to, you know, the social capital and the relationship fabric of the organization. And it's a very big shift from what we understand leadership to be like, you know, especially pre-pandemic.
So, you know, that's a massive shift. So if you're a board and you're looking at your executive team, you know, managing that company, you really need to say to yourself, have I got the right leadership for today? So going on to compression of learning, you know, do you think we've lost that art of people management? Because certainly as a young person in a bank and a young manager, I was sent away for 2 weeks to train to be a manager. And okay, I know it comes from personality as well, but at least I was given that kind of grounding as a young manager on the process and how I should just provide feedback and simple things like that. But I think that's changed, isn't it, with this compression of learning? So
yeah, it's a catch-22 scenario. So I would say that most companies perhaps realize that the leadership population doesn't have the skills that are really interpersonal or oriented to coaching and mentoring others, or maybe they don't have the time, again, to coach and mentor others informally, like it would happen in the office at a coffee machine or et cetera. But then we have less and less time to dedicate to learning this day. So you mentioned 2 weeks, you know, to a training kind of boot camp where you learn lots of stuff and develop lots of skills. That's gone. I would say even our training programs pre-COVID could last on average 2 days, 1.5 days. Then that's gone down to 1 day, then half day, then 3 hours, then 90 minutes. And now the standard has become 1 hour. So on one hand, you got this need to really strengthen and focus on these leadership skills and interpersonal skills, like, again, coaching, mentoring, compassionate leadership. On the other hand, also people have less time, organizations don't make time for the type of learning. So it's a catch-22. Also, I think working remotely has led us to be more sedentary, as we were saying, but actually having these constant meetings. I like this quote that I read somewhere. So hybrid teams do more meetings, but have fewer relationships. So, you know, it's like we meet a lot, but actually it can be very transactional. And on top of this, like the cherry on top of this cake, you have the digital fatigue that also plays a role. So, you know, you would have heard of Zoom fatigue. Yeah. So people are exhausted usually after a day of meetings or remote meetings because you have this constant attentional focus on other people. And in trying to make eye contact with 20 people at once, you have a mirror in front of you, you have your face, and that can create a lot of anxiety and self-monitoring. And also not moving increases the cognitive load. So how do we, in a way, you know, we have less time for learning, we're more exhausted, but we need to acquire the skills now more than ever. So it's a real conundrum for organizations.
It is. I think my record for online meetings in one day was 14.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can imagine what your brain is like at the end of the day. Yeah. But how can we tackle this? How can we tackle this compression of learning? Because for me, it's all going down it's going down the wrong road. We need to learn and grow and develop as an individual to have that, you know, focus on that purpose. Where are we going? Yeah. How do we tackle it?
Well, first of all, as I said, when I'm you know, in a meeting of 14 hours, then you have very little time for self-reflection, right? First of all, which is one key component of learning. We forget that we learn by reflecting on our experiences. Secondly, now organizations are confusing exposure to information with actual learning, you know? So, you know, even if we do a webinar training session, let's say 90 minutes to an hour on a topic, it doesn't mean that people are learning. It means that people are exposed to that content, but internalizing it and making it yours and making it even relevant to your day-to-day job can be difficult. So what can we do? I think we need to accept that the way we learn has changed. And I think we need to adapt the learning, if you like, to the demands of today's kind of workforce and organizational load. And I think, you know, that can focus on shorter sessions, but actually more experiential learning. So a little bit of content, but more self-reflection time and more opportunities to put that content into practice. Oh. So we call them like workouts. You know, we work with an organization specializes in designing those workouts. And their ratio seem to be very effective for busy people and busy, you know, a busy workforce. So a little bit of content, self-reflection, how we think about this topic as a group and what actions can we implement moving forward. Then 90 minutes, but they not teaching anything or much. They're more around eliciting that kind of response, a learning response from people.
So again, you know, people are going to have to be flexible when they think about training their people, aren't they? So leadership, HR, and we're going to get onto HR. So, you know, I asked you the question, if you were running a big sort of financial services company, how would you balance that kind of hybrid working? And we talked about flexibility. Companies are still struggling to get their employees back into the office. So there's a real resistance. And I think probably I'm generalizing here, from the older generation are more resistant than the younger generations. How do you think they can persuade the people to come back into the office? So if you had this company and you knew you needed to bring them in to build that social capital, what would you do to persuade them?
Well, first of all, I think I would ask myself if I've explained well enough why you should be back in the office, you know, because as I mentioned, some roles actually perform better from home. So if you think of very technical jobs like legal, accounting, those who need a high level of kind of focus on details and time management, they don't necessarily need to be back at the office to perform. So they will be thinking, you know, if I was, you know, in one of those jobs, why? Why do you want me back? Yeah. Now, again, early career, client-facing roles, business development, all the also teams that focus on creativity and innovation, they struggle the most. But if that is the case, then explain that, you know, to your colleagues and say why this is important. Or maybe, you know, I perform very well as an individual, but the team and the collaboration without the business unit is not working out. And that is why maybe we should be back at the office. But I've sensed particularly that when hybrid working kicked off, many leaders felt scared by the lack of control and monitoring they had. So I think for many colleagues in the organization, this push to come back to the office can actually be perceived as a controlling measure. Yeah. I need to watch you and you to be close to me to see what you're doing. I don't trust you.
Yeah.
You know, it's about trust again. So is it an issue of trust? Is it an issue of effectiveness and performance? You need to be very clear in your messaging. You know, otherwise people will be like, why should I be back?
Yeah.
And if you can't answer that question, don't expect others to have the answer for you. That would be my advice.
Yeah, it's not an easy concept, is it, for leaders to sort of like manage these days? It has completely changed. I was actually going to give an example of a company that I think has done a really good job of managing the kind of hybrid working. It's a company called RSM. They're an audit company. And I know some of the people that work there, and I know they really like the company from a cultural perspective. So we do need to touch on culture at some point, because I think this leads the way. But even if you go onto their website and you look at how they discuss, you know, how they manage the workforce, you know, that they quote, "We don't believe in a fixed approach to how our people work. Being flexible helps us meet the needs of our clients and our people, no matter what that looks like. We trust our people to find the right balance of working in the office, at client sites and at home. Our teams can deliver even better client work with the right support and flexibility from us." Now, that for me is...
That was a key word there, right?
Yeah.
Trust.
Yes.
We trust our...
people. Yeah. We trust our people. Yeah. And that's the same, you know, approach I tried to make when I was working in financial services, was actually making sure that there was that bond between me and the team and I could trust them. I had to. That's
you,
long.
Yeah, you're not there to monitor what they do in a way, but that it links back to the notion of social capital, why it's so important. Yeah. And I think something that we forgot in some ways, you know, hybrid working came out of necessity because of the pandemic and we had to be working from home. And then people realized, hey, it works. It's not the end of the world. Because, you know, before the pandemic, it was unthinkable even to do training remotely. Now it's only remote training that we do. But again, people forgot that it worked because there was so much social capital that had been built over the years, right? It just, you know, we didn't get a bunch of strangers in an organization and ask them to work together from day one remotely, right? That was the foundation. But then with newer generations coming in, more kind of colleagues joining the organization, that created a gap. Whereas, you know, the social capital that was not consolidated was not built anymore. Mm. And that's where the gap is. But in the example that you've given me, I assume, you know, there is a high level of trust in this organization. Therefore, flexibility is the key word. You know, do as you think is best for you and the organization. And the second one is we trust people to do well despite the way you're working.
And I think from this, you know, RSM's perspective, from what I understand, is it does come from the top. You know, one of the things that he actually says to his, you know, employees is bring your authentic self to work. And I think that cultural aspect's really important. And although you talk about social capital, I actually manage a merger in the middle of COVID. So I actually inherited a brand new team and I had to merge the two businesses and the two teams. And I didn't meet the new team face to face for months. Now, that was tricky. But what we did is we really focused on how could we do as much as we possible online. So it was all on Zoom. So I used to hold a daily Zoom meeting at lunchtime. Anyone could attend, but you didn't have to. But people just joined just to say hello. There was no agenda. It was really, what did you do over the weekend? Most popular days were Mondays and Fridays because people were talking about their weekends either end of the week.
Yeah.
But people started to get to know each other. We held online quizzes. We did cocktail making online at Christmas. And we did as much as we could to try and build the team collaboration. And personally, I made sure I spoke to people every day. I held weekly one-to-ones instead of monthly one-to-ones. So I really had to work hard. I spent my whole day. That's why I got up to 14 meetings in one day, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Just because I spent
You were making an investment in the social capital.
And it did work. Yeah. And it did bring the two teams together. Wasn't perfect. Yeah. It obviously built, you know, further progressed and developed and we all got back into the office. But we had a good 8-9 months of, you know, conducting a merger without meeting each other. So how do you feel that HR has been impacted by all of this change of a kind of a huge dynamic of how we work?
Well, clearly, as is often the case, HR is in the middle of it. So on one hand, you have all these pressing needs from different stakeholders, policies, you know, are being drafted. It's a very tough position to be in. There's no doubt around it, right? Because you got the senior stakeholders kind of point of view, you got the employees' point of view, you got maybe external stakeholders' viewpoints as well. I think, you know, what happens in these situations, it's about trying to find a balance, but also, or a compromise. But that compromise may not work for everyone. And that's kind of, you know, the difficulty with HR navigating those pressures. Now, HR also has an influencing role in the organization. And I think that sometimes that role is not leveraged strongly enough. So do you see your HR department as being in sort of executing, you know, as an execution function of, if you like, priorities that are, you know, dictated from the top? Or do you see your HR function as a consultative kind of platform that can be also influencing policies and outcomes? That will shape a lot of, if you like, you know, the challenges that HR experience, but also that will shape a lot of HR responses to those challenges.
Well, what do you think that HR can actually do to bridge that gap as well between the organization and the employee needs?
Mm. Well, I would say don't be afraid to really influence and challenge.
Yes.
You know, very often, you know.
Lean forward.
Yes. Go for it, you know, because this is a crucial, I suppose, component that will have an impact on so many things, from turnover to health and well-being to attraction of talent. You know, if you're very rigid about your flexible working policies, I'm not going to be particularly perhaps attracted to your organization. So it's a really big, important topic. And very often I feel that HR is reluctant to challenge the thinking of senior leaders for good reason, you know, of course, but also gather information, you know, build a case for it. We have so many tools, for instance, you know, as a company in our portfolio that enable the organization to give a voice to many different stakeholders, you know. So you got things like engagement surveys that are very popular, but there's also cultural surveys. If you ask people, they will tell you what the needs are most of the time. So HR can be a kind of mediator between the needs of the workforce and the priorities of the top leaders in the organization.
And do you think hybrid working has dropped off the HR priority list?
I don't know. I think it's become like accepted and sometimes reluctantly. So okay, it's here to stay. We can't do anything about it. So again, let's find a compromise that seems to, you know, kind of one size fits all. And then obviously we realize that because of the complexity of the problem, one size fits all doesn't exist. So it has become like something that we got accustomed to, but I don't think that we don't so in a mindful and purposeful way, right? So again, if you become a victim of hybrid working as an organization, it's not quite the same as purposely designing for it, which is a more proactive approach.
Chris, before we jump on to our next question, I know you've done tons of research on HR. Have you got any kind of anything to add to HR's role in hybrid working to what Andrea has already said?
For sure. And you're really spot on, Pat, and Andrea is really spot on. But HR traditionally acts as the organizational caregivers. Mm-hmm. So they are the people who are taking care of the people.
Yeah.
And they're usually overlooked. In the research, they're underrepresented and under-researched, and they're one of the occupational groups that report the highest burnout. Nobody knows about that. Nobody talks about that because it's HR.
It's madness, though, isn't it? I'm constantly shocked by how, it's probably the wrong way to say it, but they're not respected, HR. For me, they look after the most important asset within a company, any company, is its people. And therefore, why does HR not have that kind of top seat? For me, I've always tried to work collaboratively with my HR teams because I've seen them as the people that support me on the thing that's most important to me, my people. Like you say.
It goes back to leadership.
It does go back to leadership.
How open you are to people, the topic of people, if you see the links, you know, between people and results, and also if you're open to being influenced by other functions and departments. If you're not, I guess, as a leader, you're more directive and perhaps less interested in those topics, you won't give HR probably the level of influence that you could have or
and it attention. It should have. Yeah. I've watched over the years having, a large HR team sit within a business and then it'd be centralized, so taken away from that business and centralized within a large or global corporate. And I think, well, they're now not connected with the rest of the organization and the people. They're just a processing machine, which I think is another subject altogether that we could talk about for hours.
Yeah, and I think HR should also look for external support. Mm-hmm. HR should work with occupational health consultants. They should work with business psychologists. They should work together to get more data and evidence on how to create healthier, happier workplaces. Because sometimes HR may think inside the box, and I think this is a big caveat, and they have to work collaboratively or upskill and reskill on occupational health, well-being, because HR is mainly business or management field. It's not entirely psychology. So they have to be open to learn more as their world of work evolves.
In our recent survey, over 80% of respondents said that hybrid working enhances the organization's ability to attract and retain talent. Do you agree?
It's absolutely essential. A study last year happened in the UK and showed that one out of three employees would consider quitting if they're forced back to the office 5 days in a week. Mm-hmm. And there is more data to support that 35% of job seekers said that a five-day in-office policy would be a deal breaker. So hybrid working is not luxury anymore. It's perceived as something is foundational.
Yeah.
It's not a nice to have just to attract talent. You should have it. Otherwise, people will look to find more flexible environments to work within. Now, LinkedIn did a really interesting study last year. It take a snapshot on 10,000 US professionals. And there was a really interesting insight around the sense of lack of control for full-time employees. So what they found is that self-employed and freelancers are feeling more in control of their careers than full-time employees. Can you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
2 decades ago, or even 10 years ago, people were finding a full-time job to feel more in control, to have more security.
Wow.
So this is another element that I think is playing in that context, that why to work full-time, even hybrid setup or going to the office, mm-hmm. even if I don't feel that security and I'm in control. And leadership has to influence that, and they have to support people. Otherwise, I think my prediction would be that people will exit companies and they will do their own passion projects. They will do their gigs, their YouTube channels, TikTok, especially early careers, or creating even a farm or doing multiple projects, because also how we perceive career is changing.
Yeah,
the old model was like climbing the corporate ladder, and you know, Pat and Andrea, and chasing a title and money. But people now are caring more about their satisfaction and health rather than pay or promotion. And if they can get that, they will create it their own.
It's a completely different change of mindset, isn't it? I've been talking about this with my father as well, and he just said, oh my gosh, he said, I don't know if I could cope in the workplace, especially as a leader, because it's a really different mindset. So do you think also, you know, that the hybrid working leads to, I suppose, greater exposure of diversity of thought as well within the business? So from a business, if I'm looking at, I need diversity of thought within my organization, so that I make sure that I've got creativity, resilience. Do you think hybrid working helps with that?
Absolutely. Diversity.com did a study on women and employees of color, and they showed that they're more likely to stay, these groups, when hybrid work is supported. Now, there's another study from Queen Mary, happened last year, and they're also sort of the flexibilities and non-negotiable for parents, especially fathers, they mentioned, I would argue, and mothers, and I would also argue for everyone who is living, even by themselves or not having children, everyone has in their household invisible challenges. Mm-hmm. And the people that they don't care of children or others, they have maybe more challenges and they're overlooked. So I think they're all equally important, but we're focusing more on parents and carers.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also people living by themselves and they're suffering.
I agree. And this is a silly question, but it'd just be nice to close off this part of the chat. Do you think that hybrid working is here to stay?
Is here to stay and to evolve.
Yeah.
We can't predict how hybrid working will evolve in the future. And this will depend on microeconomic situations. I mean, everything that is happening now in the market in terms of trade wars, economic uncertainty, potential future global recession will have an impact on how hybrid work will evolve. But it's here, I think flexibility is here to stay. Otherwise, people will create their own flexibility. And I think organizations should be more worried than people, because people have the chance to take a step back, reflect, and find ways and resources. And even if they don't have resources, they may have resourcefulness, and they can create their own jobs rather than working for organizations that don't value their job.
Organizations need to be listening to this podcast today.
Kevin, we mentioned AI, by the way.
and
the links they could have, that's a whole different topic, you know, but to add to this ever-evolving complexity of hybrid work and how also the challenges that leaders are facing in trying to juggle all of these risks plus the advancement of AI in the organization. You can also understand, you know, thinking that maybe we've been a little harsh towards leaders, that they have a lot to juggle. And this is another thing that perhaps they just won't it done, you know, in some ways. But who knows how it will evolve as well with the advancement of AI. It's fascinating, and I suppose we'll see.
Well, Andrea, that leads nicely on to our next podcast, which will be looking at AI.
Oh,
so
yes.
Thank you for the plug.
Of course.
So just to finish off, the same question to you both. Chris, first, if that's okay. Could you leave our listeners with two top tips on hybrid working?
Yes. Tip one would be don't leave connection and physical activity to chance. And even people working in the office, they're not immune of prolonged sitting or connection. And tip two would be to protect your energy with clear boundaries. Both leaders and employees, they should protect their energy. Otherwise, they will burn out or they will have to find another job. And now people change jobs more quickly than it used to be 5 years or 10 years ago. So we say 3 months staying in a job, 6 months, 12 months. So these are my two tips.
Brilliant. Thank you, Chris. Andrea?
Yeah, mine are going to be kind of different and generic, but the number one tip would be, again, as I said before, don't think of it as a policy. It is a social architecture, social engineering kind of live
really
thing.
Key point.
Yes.
Really.
And the second would be review periodically, often. Just because something may not work today doesn't mean that it can't work in a few months' time and vice versa. Just because something is working now, it doesn't mean that it will work as, you know, everything evolves and changes over time.
Brilliant. So thank you both. Brilliant advice. Listeners, listen to these two guys carefully. They are both amazing and I love talking to them both. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for everyone listening to our first The Culture Debate podcast, where we aim to be innovative and creative thinking around the world of work and sustainable thinking. See you soon. Bye.